Welcome back to Is It Horror?
I'm Brianna.
I'm Joe.
I'm Matt.
I'm Mitz.
And I'm Steve. And if you haven't joined us before, why? Why haven't you been joining us before? We've been making all these episodes. You haven't been showing up. What the hell?
We've been working so hard.
Yeah, get in here, bitches.
But in any case, if you haven't been here before, that's fine. It's fine, I guess. But what we do is we overthink movies that may or may not be horror, and we figure out if we think they qualify and discuss all the reasons why that might be or why it might not be. We do have planned to cover some other media. We're going to cover at least one video game here during this first season of our show. So stick around and you'll get more information on that as time goes. But before we get into our movie, it is tradition that we go to Joe's Get to Know You Corner. And so here we go to the corner.
Welcome to the corner. Today, this movie, The Lighthouse, which we'll be talking about, well, I won't get into it, but I mean, it's about a really bad job experience, basically. So I was curious what everybody's worst or a bad job employment or bad boss or what have you experience you've had.
I've had a couple really weird grown-up job experiences. Usually it involves a company that tells me that I'm like family and it always ends poorly. But I find that pretty much any job where you have to engage in like sales and customer service, that is like a sure path to hell.
For sure. Was that all for you, Brianna?
I think so. I should probably not name names to protect the not so innocent.
Fair. Okay, cool. I can agree definitely with pretty much any job you have to deal with. Customers can be really terrible. I've had a few of those types of things. I've been fairly lucky to have pretty good bosses, so I haven't had any of those types of things. But I did have one more dramatic than like, well, it wasn't terrible for me, but it was terrible for another employee or for a coworker, I should say. Where they ran their hand through a table saw, and that
is a horror.
Yeah, it was right. Yeah, it kind of was. And I had to, I took him to the hospital, and yeah, it was just like across his whole palm. And after I took him there, I went home and had to like hose out my car from the blood. So yeah, that was
straight up Goodfellas shit right there.
So I actually worked at the cabinet shop that Joe mentioned during this same incident, and so I have the pleasure of being able to tell you that if you need to clean human skin off of a saw blade, that it's a lot like peeling wax.
Oh god, okay.
Should have saved that for the Chainsaw Massacre episode.
I know, right?
Yeah, it's a bit late coming, I suppose.
Yeah, I took him to the hospital and Steve had to stay back and clean up the mess.
Yeah, it was weird. It was surreal.
So yeah, my worst job experience, there was no cutting of limbs, but my first real job, I worked at Sears in a mall that my brother and I both frequented quite a bit. And it was just a crappy job because they didn't really care about anybody. Everybody there was like 16 and we would have like probably a dozen customers a day. And it was just a really boring job experience. That's really all that was bad about it.
I've had a lot of like part-time jobs growing up as a teenager and a college student. And one of the jobs that I had was in a plastic bottle factory. So my job was to stand at the line and there would be those empty Tropicana bottles for orange juice, the jugs. And my job was to pick it up, look at it, make sure there was no dents, and put it back down for 8 hours. It was very, very boring.
That sounds really boring.
What do you put on a job listing for that? Look at bottles.
Expert bottle examiner.
Must have experience looking at bottles.
It was so exciting when you got to throw one away because it had like a scratch or something. Oh, I was like, oh, I found one! It's like a golden ticket.
I would totally talk that up on my resume, though, and put like a structural analysis engineer.
Yeah.
Bottle structural analysis engineer. There you go.
Quality assurance technician.
Jug examiner.
That's a different job. Totally different set of requirements for that.
Right.
I think my worst job experience was when I briefly, I think it couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 weeks, worked at a payday loan place because I desperately needed a job and that's what was available. And it was terrible and nonspecific. I know there's probably jobs like this that people enjoy and really thrive on, but it was one of those places where during training, I'd come in and they're like, okay, well, you're going to have to get these referrals and you're going to have to call on these referrals and, you know, get people into these loans where we'll give them $300 if they pay us $900 back. And I'm like, okay, what time should I be here for training? Well, the earlier you get here, the better the referrals are. Okay, well, what time is that I should get there? Well, you don't have to come until 9, but it is better if you get here earlier. Okay, well, how early do you want me here? And they really wouldn't tell me. It was like one of those things where they had a group of 3 or 4 of us for training, and they were just hoping that we'd all show up at like 4 in the morning, I guess, but they wouldn't tell us that. It was weird and frustrating. And so it's a crappy job anyway, but they had kind of like this open floor plan where it's really like a small room and there's about 20 people in there. And this guy who'd been working there for a while, he decided he didn't like the way I was claiming referrals, and I've been there, you know, for like a week and have no idea what I'm doing. So he stands up. He's not a boss or anything. He's just a fellow coworker. He stands up in front of everybody and he chews me out and yells at me because I'm not putting referrals on there the right way. And it was just really terrible. And then the lady who was running the place had to fire me, but she felt terrible about it. So like, I'm being fired and she's there practically in tears telling me that she has to let me go. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, okay, this place blows. I'm happy to leave. I've never been more proud to be fired by a place. So thank you. So that's my worst job experience. It was awful. And I hope I never have to work at a place like that again.
Well, thanks for joining us on Joe's Get to Know Your Corner.
And now we're getting out of the corner and we're moving over to a small island where we are going to be talking about today's movie, The Lighthouse, from 2019. This one was directed by Robert Eggers, and it's kind of apt to be talking about it right now because his new movie, The Northman, comes out on April 22nd. His previous film, The Witch, is one that I think is more uniformly considered horror by a lot of people. This particular movie was written by both Robert, and his brother Max. I'm doing something a little bit different. I went ahead and wrote my description beforehand, so we're going to see how that goes.
Woohoo!
Yay! So, two men are left on an isolated island to man a lighthouse. There's the more verbose and veteran lighthouse keeper, Thomas Wake, played by Willem Dafoe, and the more mysterious and novice lighthouse keeper, Ephraim Winslow, played by Robert Pattinson. The relationship of the two shifts back and forth between adversarial and friendly, in some moments very friendly, at least for Dafoe. Thomas Wake tends to the lighthouse light itself, refusing to let Ephraim in, even into the highest level of the lighthouse, but instead forces him to do every other shitty job on the small island. A storm comes in and strands the two on the island for a purposely nebulous amount of time, and Ephraim is increasingly off balance and unsure of what is and isn't happening and how much time has really passed. He's extremely distrustful of Thomas. However, during a especially drunken night, Ephraim reveals that his name is actually Thomas as well. Ephraim Winslow was the name of a man he intentionally let die in a logging accident several years earlier, and Thomas assumed his identity to give himself a fresh start. A sense of time becomes less and less consistent, and events become more surreal until Ephraim Thomas can't stand it anymore and attempts to take the small emergency rowboat to leave the island. Meanwhile, Thomas Wake, Defoe, attacks him, damaging the boat and damaging it beyond use. And then the two fight until eventually Ephraim Thomas gains the upper hand and kills Thomas Wake with an axe. He finally climbs the lighthouse stairs and able to look into the light, but it's too much, and the final scene shows a naked Ephraim slash Thomas blinded and disemboweled by seagulls. And that is how our film ends. And now that I've already told you all of that, spoiler warnings. I'm really good at these spoiler warnings, guys. So, let's start digging into this. How did everybody feel about it? Was it horror? Was it not horror?
I went into this having seen the movie once and I didn't really pay attention to it, honestly, because I sleep through a lot of movies. I didn't think it was horror. And then upon my rewatch, I have decided this is horror. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, 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 dun.
I had a real hard time with this one, honestly. Like, I hadn't seen this before. We watched it a couple days ago. And over the last, like, 48 hours or so, I've been sure that it wasn't and sure that it is about three or four times each. And what I've settled on is that I do think it's horror. However, I think there's a lot more to it than that. And there's a really good Willem Dafoe quote that we'll get to a little bit later that I think sums it up really well. But yes, I will call it horror.
I think it's horror, but I think that it is psychological horror. So I had that qualifier.
I also think it's horror, and I also have a lot to say about the kind of horror I think it is later when we talk about the elements of it.
Well, this is kind of crazy. I also went back and forth on it quite a bit and was trying to decide, but I also came to the conclusion that it is horror as well. So here we are on one that was a bit contested, and we're 100% unanimous, so that's kind of crazy.
Well, guess we can end early.
I did not expect that.
All right.
Yep. We'll pack it up. Bye, guys. Yep. Peace.
Well, thanks for joining us.
I'm Mitz.
Mitz is like, peace out. I'm going to take a nap.
All right. Well, I guess before we get into this, I wanted to at least share a quote from Willem Dafoe in an interview with the Curzon Film Podcast, which I haven't listened to a lot of theirs, but they've had some really good ones when I've been looking for interviews with various people involved in these films that we've been talking about. But I thought that it helped kind of sum things up, at least to a degree. So the interviewer, who's Sam Hallett on that show, he says, "I think the tone of the film is really interesting, and the film as a genre film is interesting as well, because I think a lot of people expect this to be a full-on horror film." At that point, Willem Dafoe interjects and he says, "No, I'm crazy about getting that notion off the table, because I think that, you know, horror films you associate with jump scares and all that kind of thing. And I think people will like this movie, but if they go knowing the nature of some people, you know, if they go expecting one thing and it's not taking them to the place they've decided it should take them, then they won't be receptive enough to see the beauty of what it is. They'll say, wow, I liked it, but that wasn't a horror film. Well, forget it. It's not a horror film. It's a film. But I think that's kind of irresistible because it's hard to identify what it is, and it's clearly a genre film with a very simple story, and there's a temptation to call it horror something so people can relax and enjoy the pushed, the advanced, the sophisticated visual language and soundscape and things like that. Anytime you get out of naturalism, you know you're really liberated to a place that people are much more generous with themselves as audiences. But you gotta get them to that place first. And so that's why I think some people, for lack of a better definition, call it a horror film. It's not a horror film in the sense of a traditional way." So that's kind of the quote I had from Willem Dafoe, which was kind of funny because when I first listened to that, despite everything he's saying, it left me, I guess in a way, more sure that it was a horror film. Because, at least for me anyway, hearing that quote, it was kind of like, I think more it was him trying to say he didn't want people to go and expecting a traditional horror film experience, because I think I went into it my first watching of this expecting that, and then was kind of, not disappointed, but taken off guard because it was completely different than what I was expecting. So I guess I was kind of curious if you guys have any comments on his quote and how you felt about it. I'd be interested to hear that.
Yeah, I had pretty much the same reaction to that. It seemed like he was blatantly trying to say, don't think of it as horror, but also subtly being like, yeah, it's kind of a horror movie.
I guess my first impression hearing that is that sometimes actors like Willem Dafoe or others will probably not want to just categorize something as horror, because I think a lot of times horror gets overlooked as far as performances. And yeah. I think that his performance and definitely Robert Pattinson's performances were really elevated stuff. So I don't know. I think maybe he had a motive behind it, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that there's a tendency among cinema fans, you know, I will say cinema fans, I guess, like people that are really into film and like more complex film, to kind of discount the horror genre. So things that I think a lot of people would categorize as horror amongst the horror community don't get categorized that way by, you know, real film fanatics, because they kind of think like, well, it's horror is something that's trashy and this isn't trashy, so it can't be horror. So I think there's that tendency, which I don't obviously agree with in doing this show. So I don't know if maybe that's kind of part of what he's going with too, is he doesn't want people going and thinking about it that way because he doesn't want them to discount what it is or overlook it entirely, decide not to watch it because of hearing those things. I was curious if you did obviously we all classify this as horror, and Matt, you kind of talked about it for a moment with yours. What subgenre of horror would you fit this in if you had to?
Oh, this is... okay, so Texas Chainsaw is grindhouse horror, but this is arthouse horror.
Yeah, like I said before, I kind of think it's psychological. I don't think we've done another movie that's quite like this horror. Maybe like The Killing of a Sacred Deer was on a similar vein, where it's not necessarily... it's not horror like Michael Myers is chasing you, or horror like they're scary monsters. It's sort of more of an internal horror, and then just a really unsettling feeling. I know Mitz and I were trying to remember what we both said about The Killing of a Sacred Deer, and I still don't remember. But yeah, psychological horror for me, it's definitely different than a lot of the horror that we've watched, though.
Yeah, I think psychological horror is a good way to put it. The other, I guess, word, I don't know if it's really a subgenre, but I was thinking of it as a kind of surreal horror, or and I think it's a good way to say, like, it's a more kind of internal horror, and it's kind of the horror of going crazy or going insane. But yeah.
So I was excited to answer this question, because even though everybody was clowning me last week saying I probably wouldn't like this movie, I actually really liked it because it was more up the alley of things that I know about more. So I'm an English teacher. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that on the podcast. And I studied a lot of literature previously. And one of the genres of literature that I studied a lot was 19th century Gothic horror. And yes. As I was watching this movie,
you were my people.
Drawing a lot of comparisons to all of those stories that I read that were considered gothic horror. So elements of gothic horror would be usually depicting people in isolation, how do I explain this? It's usually depicting people slowly slipping into madness. A lot of times it's women dealing with hysteria, as they would call it in the 19th century. Generally has like a dreary mood. And sometimes there are actual monsters. So like Dracula, Frankenstein, I would consider both of those gothic horror. But a lot of times it's either the humans are the monsters causing psychological damage to the main character, or sometimes it's like within. So popular examples of that would be Jekyll and Hyde, Picture of Dorian Gray. Those are the popular ones. And then I guess if you want to think of more like contemporary stuff, it would be like Rosemary's Baby, Flowers in the Attic, which I read as a middle schooler. Do not recommend that for middle school. But so all of those stories basically deal with the main characters either in isolation because they have to be or because they were forced to be, and them slowly dealing with the madness that comes with that. Sometimes imposed by another person, like Rosemary's Baby, or sometimes it's just the circumstances, like in this movie. So I would consider this gothic horror because the horror is within. And I would also say it has elements of like Lovecraftian horror. There's images of, you know, the sea monsters and the whole idea of the sea kind of being its own character that's keeping them isolated. And a lot of Lovecraft's works, you know, dealt with sailors' insanity, sailors slipping into insanity, coming up with all these monsters. I mean, a lot of people argue if the Lovecraftian monsters are supposed to be real or in the characters' minds, because they're crazy. So I would say this is gothic, Lovecraftian, psychological horror. There, I'm done talking now.
No, that's nice. All great.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
I agree, because I was putting it in my thought process is that, it's Lovecraftian horror. The gothic horror aspect of it, that all makes sense. I didn't necessarily make that immediate connection myself, but the Lovecraftian part, I kind of felt like that worked because it's, you know, keeping what the tormentor is purposely vague, not describing it all in detail, and just describing the character's madness because of their interaction with whatever it is or whatever's in their own head, right? So there's that side of it. And I think that there's also that element throughout this film too of, you know, forbidden knowledge. I think, at least for me anyway, we can get into this a little bit when we talk about what we all feel like it means, but I feel like there's definitely weight in that final sequence of him finally looking into the light and not being able to handle what's there without ever sharing with the audience what's there. Which, I don't know, that rang very Lovecraftian to me as well.
Yeah, so that kind of had me thinking, is there a monster in the story? Like, that's something I was stuck on. Like, is this truly all in his mind? Or was this meant to be, like, the light is its own entity? That's what I was not sure about, and I was wondering what you guys thought about that. Like, was he already crazy when he looked into the light, or is that what, you know, that was his demise?
I was going to add to that. It's like the movie actually is trying really hard to make you not be sure of anything that's going on, just because Ephraim is not a reliable, like, what you're seeing through his eyes, you can't really depend on that being real or not. Like, in the one part he talks about, oh, I found the dead guy that you killed, but you're never really sure if that even happened or not either. Like, you, when it initially happens, you're like, no, that's not actually happening. And then when he brings it up to him, you're like, okay, probably, I guess that happened. And then afterwards, you're like, wait, but did it?
Yeah, and like, that's the whole film, right? Like, the whole film, you're like, I'm not sure what, if any, of these things happened. Is Thomas Wake just gaslighting Ephraim when he's contradicting him about all the things he did or didn't do, or how long it's been, or is that actually the truth? And you don't really ever know. Which is kind of funny too, because Robert Pattinson was talking to Robert Eggers about all the stuff as he was reading the script, and he's kind of like, so did any of this stuff happen? And Eggers' response was basically like, I don't know, what do you think?
So I think I came away with it. I mean, I think it's totally open to interpretation, but it makes sense in my head that probably Ephraim was a bit crazy before the movie even starts. And I think that probably started, or maybe was even before, the whole logging accident where his foreman, who was actually named Ephraim, died and he didn't help him. And he's been like struggling with some of the guilt and some of the like mental issues with that ever since. and he comes to the island and like dealing with Thomas Wake, who's just this crotchety old sailor dude who just is probably gaslighting him a bit, and also just taking every opportunity to, you know, be the boss and be the tough guy is just like the worst thing for him in that. And it just pushes him further and further into his mental issues and into his madness. And he just starts seeing things and it just gets worse and worse. So yeah, I guess that's kind of what I ended up feeling like was probably happening. And that's, I guess, also there's a whole bunch of symbolism and stuff too.
In my heart of hearts, I want to believe that the sea monsters are real and the mermaid is real and all of the things happened and the island is its own entity manifested by the light, etc., etc. I just need to believe that Cthulhu came to the party. That's all.
I mean, really, so long as you're keeping Cthulhu in your heart, he's at every party.
Right. Praise Cthulhu.
Praise Cthulhu.
I think one of the things that made me feel the way I did was like a pretty early scene. I don't remember exactly the timeline of it. And the movie keeps the timeline vague intentionally anyways. But like pretty early in the movie, Ephraim has a little moment on the beach where he like walks out into the water and there's all the logs around and he sees like the back of the head of who I assume is actually Ephraim. But he seems to already be dealing with some of those issues.
Yeah, like that experience is slowly eating away at him and has been eating away at him.
Right.
So one of the things I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit with this one, at least for me anyway, is I felt like the atmosphere played a big part in how I ended up feeling about the movie. Which it was kind of interesting to hear a little bit about Robert Edgar's process with this, because I have a quote here, I guess, about it, but he was being interviewed in Vox and the interviewer saying, "This movie's hard to categorize, but to me it feels like a fable. It may be a fable about damned souls trying to make themselves clean. Was any of that in your mind while you were writing it?" And so he says, "The idea of a fable or a myth is definitely at the forefront of our process. I start with atmosphere. My brother had an idea, a ghost running the lighthouse that created a look and a feeling of a world in my head. Then we got the very basic strokes of the story based on a real story about two lighthouse keepers, both named Thomas, who get stranded on their lighthouse station and one of them dies." And so I'd seen a couple interviews where Robert Eggers was talking about his process in terms of this, and it was almost like he just had this clear visual picture of a feel that, you know, an atmosphere overall that he had in mind, and then everything that he created, the story and everything that goes into it, was in service of that feeling. And so I know we've kind of touched on a little bit, but I was curious how everyone would describe the atmosphere of this film. Like, if you're describing it to someone who's never seen it, how would you say the film feels?
It feels really oppressive. I think it was the lighting and the fact that they did it in black and white that it just felt oppressive. I felt a little claustrophobic just in the way that the movie was shot, really.
The aspect ratio where it's, I don't know what it is, but it's, you know, just in the little boxy format also, I think, lends to that feeling of claustrophobia.
Yeah, I like that they never really, I don't think they ever like pulled away to do like a widescreen shot, even of like the coastline or the horizon. Like everything just felt incredibly focused and incredibly tight.
Claustrophobic is exactly the word I was going to use. And oppressive is also a very good word. It just, it already gives you the feeling of being trapped on the island as you're watching it.
I think as I was watching it, it kind of felt like if an Alfred Hitchcock movie and There Will Be Blood made a baby and this was the movie.
Yeah. Yep. That's a really good way to describe it.
And especially the feeling that it brings you with just the music, like the soundtrack in the movie, really creates a lot of the atmosphere, I think. The kind of suspenseful music.
I was just going to ask, did anybody else like have a low-key panic attack in the beginning when that foghorn kept going?
Oh, yes. I was like, is this going to be the whole movie?
Right. I was really kind of afraid for a minute that was going to be the whole movie, but it really set a tone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the foghorn definitely sets a tone for the movie, and like you hear it throughout, and I think that's part of it too, part of the soundtrack, not just the music, but the noises that you're hearing, right?
Can you imagine how traumatic that would be if that was the whole movie? Oh my gosh, I'd be hearing that in my sleep.
And I think that's interesting too, because it sort of it blends in and out of the background, right? I'm not entirely sure that it wasn't going the entire film, I guess, is the impression I'm left with at the end. And mm-hmm. Probably it wasn't, but it does kind of blend in and out, and you sort of forget about it for a moment, and then it comes back.
Yeah, I don't know. That's one of those, like, it's a terrible job things, because it was bad for us to watch the movie, but I mean, people actually did and do that stuff and have to sit next to a foghorn for a month.
In the rain.
No wonder people drank all damn day.
Right.
Also, that everything is all just always wet all the time and everything's leaking. It kind of put me on the same level of discomfort as like maybe even like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like seeing the setting there. So like that whole everything being wet all the time really does a lot for the atmosphere.
And I don't know who thinks the ocean smells good, because the ocean smells like dead fish. I don't care where you are. It stinks. It is not a good smell.
Yeah, it's true.
I think it's really interesting to hear that the process was what his process was, and that he started with atmosphere. One of the things I ended up feeling about this movie was it reminded me of looking at a piece of art, like going and looking at a painting in a museum. And because of how it is, where it's like, it doesn't want you to have sure footing on like the timeline, on what's happening, on what exactly, it's not going to tell you exactly what to think about everything. Like you kind of have to decide what your thoughts and your impressions are of it. It presents this thing to you, and then you kind of have to examine it yourself. Mm-hmm. That's what it made me feel. So I think it's really interesting. I guess that it tracks for me that he's like, my priority is to start with the atmosphere, and that's what I want it to be.
I definitely don't think this was a movie that was meant to be just consumed. It was meant to be dissected like we're doing. So you're welcome, Robert Eggers.
Yeah, I definitely think so. It's kind of interesting too, just hearing some of the description he had of the process of making the film too, with talking about the sound design, because he was saying that he had, you know, the person who's working on the sound design for the film, as well as the people working on the score for the film, that it kind of like blended back and forth more than on his previous film, or I guess other films that he's seen worked on, where it was like there was some back and forth between both. So, you know, it's got the sound guy working on stuff that ends up being soundtrack, and the, you know, people working on the soundtrack making things that end up being sound effects in the film. So it kind of blends together in that way, at least to create some of that feeling. The other thing I was curious about as well is that there was some pushback when he was making this film from producers and distributors to film all of this in color so that potentially a color version could have been made, or to film it in a normal aspect ratio. So I was kind of curious if that would have changed where you guys would have weighed in on this, if it had been color and just normal framing of, you know, the standard film that you normally see. Would that have made a difference?
I think it would have taken a lot away from what the film ended up being.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that doing this in color would do the movie justice. I think it would take away too much.
Yeah, I think when you're watching it in the black and white and the aspect ratio, it's almost like you're sitting in a middle school English class and you're watching this movie or reading like Shakespeare or something like that as a group. It almost feels like that. And if you put it in color and made it look normal, I think it would just feel very, very different. feels older. And like I was saying too, Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe, both being in black and white, it makes it feel more like you're in that time period also.
Back before color was invented in the real world and everyone was just walking around in black and white.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, it feels like you're in that old world, and it feels like it was filmed in that old world.
I think I read, oh, I should have written this stuff down. One of the articles I read about the lighting and the black and white aspect, I think it also said that they actually shot this with lenses for the cameras that were actually from the 1930s. So, they didn't show as much light as you normally would, because of course, you know, things were done on sound stages and not outside normally back in that time. So they had to actually like bounce electric lights off of like sheets of muslin or something just to get the scenes lit appropriately to film it through these fancy schmancy old school antique lenses. So there's your trivia.
And it was like such bright light that in the interior scenes, when it's at night, you've got crew members full on wearing sunglasses because of how bright it is.
Yeah,
I had read that.
Yeah, and it's not just the aspect ratio or the black and white. It's also the fact that it was almost, you know, it was filmed in a way that movies would have been filmed in the 1930s or around that general area, because there was very little movement in the camera. There's very little panning and zooming and anything like that. It's sort of just flat scenes. And then when they did pan, like there, I remember there was a really cool pan up the lighthouse. You noticed, because it didn't happen the entire movie. It was cool. It's like it could have been taken out of a film canister just for us to rewatch.
Yeah.
Fun fact, there were going to be scenes where it was like a close up of the lighthouse, and then it was going to cut to Robert Pattinson's erect penis. But they decided not to do that because film or the sponsors or people didn't want it.
Yeah, I had heard that too. And I was like, that's crazy that is a thing that they were considering doing.
That is funny.
It's art, damn it. They don't need to explain it to you.
I mean, that's kind of the mantra of the whole film, right?
Pretty much.
Release the penis cut. Release the penis cut.
Release the cut.
Release it's in the cracking. Extended version.
Release
circumcise that film.
There's so many good jokes. I love it.
Which is funny. I guess I don't necessarily put this as a category, but I think that there is a lot of both phallic and yonic imagery in this movie, right? Because you've got the mermaid and, you know, seeing a mermaid's vagina and how that's depicted, and that's pretty obvious. But then you've got Robert Eggers in every interview talking about basically he's got these two men living in a phallic symbol with the lighthouse. So there's certainly a lot of that going on too. I don't know if that's something that, I guess, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it's rife with puppy play. I hope everybody remembers their safe word.
The safe word is more daddy.
Oh, I think there's definite homoeroticism here, even if it's not something where I don't think it's useful to debate whether or not these two characters are inherently hetero or homosexual. I think that the point is how their experiences on the island are simultaneously driving them together, because they're both experiencing extreme isolation, frustration, etc. And they also hate each other's guts, because, you know, farts. You goddamn farts. Best line. Best line.
Goddamn,
well,
goddamn farts.
It's so good.
It's true, right? Because they're both so, I mean, it's true about the farts, obviously, but it's true that they're both very isolated and craving human connection. And when they're both drunk, they're willing to indulge in some of that connection that they can't seem to get when they're both stone cold sober.
Yeah, well, they're all like cuddling and slow dancing, and they nearly kiss, and then it takes that for them to kind of be like, oh, no, we can't do this.
Look, I don't know if you've ever had turpentine and honey, but baby, what happens in the lighthouse stays in the lighthouse.
Monkey pump.
Monkey pump.
Safe word is monkey pump.
There you go.
Ooh, write that down.
No way to misinterpret that. So I also wanted to kind of go in, since we're talking about it already, you know, the relationship between the two Thomases. It's constantly shifting throughout the film, and I wanted to see how those shifts back and forth in that relationship, how that affected your viewing of it as horror or not horror.
I think that that was one of the only ways that we were going to feel empathy or be invested in either one of these characters in any way, because they're both pretty terrible people, like, for all intents and purposes. They're not the worst, but these are not shining stars of humanity that we're seeing.
Yeah, and I don't know, one of those things about how much it shifts and how quickly it shifts is, it's just, you just have to question a little bit how much of that is actually happening, though, or if that's more in Ephraim's head. I don't know. I'm not sure, I guess. Another thing that I had come across a little bit in thinking and researching about this is some of the symbolism in, like, the Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thomas Wake is kind of meant to represent Proteus, who I don't know much about, or I haven't known much about. I did a little bit of looking in my research for this movie, but, you know, he's just sort of kind of supposed to be a god of sorts, an old man of the sea sort of thing. But his character is supposed to, like, kind of, or his, who he is malleable and ever-changing and kind of a very fluid type person, or god, I guess. And so that kind of tracks through this movie, that I think that's very solid symbolism for him. I want to talk about this a little bit later, maybe, and then Ephraim is, you know, is a symbol of Prometheus for various reasons. I guess I brought that part up just because of we were talking about the varying degrees of their relationship, and that made a lot of sense with Defoe's character being supposed to be kind of a symbol for Proteus.
I was also thinking about how Robert Pattinson kind of sort of projects onto Willem Dafoe's character too, and it could be kind of relating to how they both share the same name, but, you know, he knows that he's basically killed this other person, Ephraim, and then he starts getting suspicious and accusing Thomas of having killed the other lighthouse worker, and you are never sure if that really happened or didn't happen, but it's kind of like he starts to see a lot of himself in the other Thomas, so there's definitely symbolism there, and them both sharing the same name, like maybe they're sort of supposed to symbolize the same person at different stages of their life.
I saw one theory that it is a cycle and they actually are the same person. But
I was wondering.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that.
I also wondered that too. Go ahead, Mitz, you first.
No, I have no more thoughts. I was just saying that is a thought that crossed my mind when I was watching the movie, because there's a lot of parallels between them as characters.
I was wondering if maybe this is a student becoming the teacher situation, and the lighthouse / island sort of just recycles folks over and over again. Like, it brings you in, it kills you, you replace the person before you, and the cycle starts again. I don't know if they ever really verified that in the movie, but I did get that sense, so I'm glad I wasn't alone on that journey.
Yeah, it's maybe even like sort of a stand-in for like purgatory or something like that.
Yeah.
I tended to kind of view it a little bit more of I don't know, I guess as a bit of an allegory, right? Like, you've got the part of yourself that we have the way that we view ourselves, the way that we think of ourselves, and that's seldom who we actually are. And so in a way you've got, I guess I viewed it as Ephraim kind of trying to ignore who he actually is and going through this process of trying to see who he actually is, and his finally going up and looking into the light and seeing like, okay, that is who I actually am. And then not being able to take that experience, not being able to reconcile with himself, like, okay, I thought I was all these other things, but I've been doubting that, and now I'm seeing myself for the first time as I actually am, and I can't take it. That knowledge is, that's the knowledge that ends up chewing him up at the end. Like, I can't, you know, he's sitting there, I can't reconcile who I actually am. And in some way, like, Defoe, almost the call back to sanity and his finally killing him, basically, like, you know, Thomas Wake being there saying, like, you're not ready to look in the light. You're not ready for that kind of self-analysis. You're not ready for that kind of self-awareness. So you need to stop. But then him finally, like, killing him off and then actually looking and then having it go that way. I don't know. I kind of looked at it as that sort of self-analysis, which I think any way you look at it is probably valid. But I guess that's the way that resonated the most with me.
Another question I wrote down on my little notes underneath Are There Monsters was, who is actually mad? Who is the mad one of the pair? I think realistically they both are mad. But the beginning of the movie sets up Ephraim to be the same one, or the sane one, and Thomas to be the insane one, with the way that he is vehement about Ephraim not going up the lighthouse, saying it's his. And Thomas is just kind of, or Ephraim is just like, okay, dude, what's your problem? But by the end of the movie, when Ephraim is insisting that he goes up to the lighthouse, it suddenly seems like Thomas is the sane one and he's talking him down. And you start to wonder, like, maybe he was just protecting him all along because he knows that Ephraim cannot handle this knowledge because he's Prometheus. And that was Prometheus's downfall. I don't know. It's kind of switched who I thought the, quote, villain was, if there is a villain in this story.
I definitely think you're onto something. I was about to say, too, about, it's kind of, it's almost like a, like, Thomas, Willem Dafoe's character is, like, an older, more experienced person, and he knows what's going to happen if you look at the light, and he knows that it's fucked him up. But he wants to protect his younger self, or his younger protege in this case, from making that mistake, the same mistake, sort of. So it's almost like we're kind of onto something, I think, with them being maybe the same person in different stages. I mean, there's definitely a father-son dynamic, too, also. So
I think an interesting thing that I'd come across as well while kind of looking into this was kind of an idea that a lot of the surreal things or just some of the things in the movie, the symbolism and that kind of thing, has kind of a progression to it in that, like, Defoe's character, Thomas Wake, like, he will mention something, but it doesn't show up in the movie until after he said it. Because since we're sort of seeing through Pattinson's eyes or Ephraim's eyes, so, like, an example of that was, like, the seagulls, like, Defoe's like, the seagulls are dead sailors. And, you know, Pattinson, or Ephraim, has been, you know, kind of having his little tiff with the seagulls all along. But then he has the one seagull that he's particularly having trouble with that only has one eye. And so Ephraim is assuming at that point that these are sailors. And then he thinks that Defoe's previous second is probably this seagull who only has one eye, and then later accuses Defoe of killing his one-eyed second, but Defoe never says that his second only had one eye. That all came from Robert Pattinson's character, Ephraim.
Do we think he did kill his previous second? Or did Ephraim just hallucinate that whole bit as well?
I mean, I guess that calls into question if any of it happened, right? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know either. I tend to think probably not, but I don't know for sure.
And I guess generally, since the way I'm looking at it is almost like Thomas Wake trying to call Ephraim back from the brink, at least, I don't know. And I know that doesn't entirely work out, but I guess that's an interpretation that I like. So I don't know. If in viewing it that way, I'd put more weight on whatever Thomas Wake had to say about it than what Ephraim had to say about it, maybe. So one of the things I kind of wanted to address a little bit too, just in conjunction with all of this, is a lot of the movie is left ambiguous. What happened, what didn't happen, and if there's anything in the light, if there is, what it is. Do you feel that explaining some of those things, putting a finer point on what was reality and what wasn't reality, would that have made it more or less horror for you? Would the explanation have changed things?
I think the explanation would have made it less disturbing and probably would have made it a less effective movie. I'm a big fan of the unknown, and I'm a big fan of having just enough knowledge about the weird shit that's going on to be creeped out by it, but not have the full story, because that's scarier.
Yeah, I'm usually more of a fan of literal things, and I don't really like things that are left open-ended and I don't know about them, but I really liked it in this movie. I was actually hoping that we didn't see what was in the light, and I feel like it worked out really, really well.
Yeah, I agree with that, with all of those things too. I had kind of we watched this movie and right afterwards I was like, I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know if I like it. It's maybe a little too artsy for me. But over like the couple of days thinking about it, I've come to the conclusion that I actually do like the film quite a bit. And I think part of that is because of those things and because it's left open-ended and because it's, you know, you can interpret it and think about it however you'd like to.
I also think it would have changed a lot for me if those questions were answered, and I like that they weren't. I think it would have taken a lot of the psychological horror out of it, and it definitely would have taken the Lovecraftian parts out. I mean, we'd still have a few tentacles in there. That's all good and well. But I think a big thing about, you know, Lovecraftian horror is that you don't know what the thing is. You just know that it's scary and ominous. And I like that.
Yeah, I think it definitely functions a lot better leaving it ambiguous. And I always think in horror, it's always better if you can leave some things unexplained and some things unanswered. The more familiar you are with a thing, the better you understand all of its rules. Then I think as people, like, we need to classify things, right? We need to figure out what they are. We need to quantify it. We need to understand it. And then once we understand it, then we can kind of categorize it. We can put it in a box in our head and say, like, okay, this thing goes in this specific box. And because we never get any solid answers in this film, I definitely think it makes it easier to quantify as horror. And in some way, the fact that you watch the movie and it's a little bit harder to classify, you know, whether it is or isn't horror, and if it is, what type of horror, lends itself to it being horror more easily, if that makes sense. The fact that you're not sure that it is makes it easier to say that it is, if that's not the weirdest statement ever on this show.
I don't know. We've had some pretty weird statements on this show.
This is true.
I mean, confirm. I've said most of them, and I can confirm. So,
yeah, that's why I edit you out of episodes.
But what? What?
What? As much as I complain about movies that try too hard to be artsy, I think this movie particularly was really refreshing because, I don't know, this is probably the English teacher nerdy side of me, but I think there is something really special about a story that doesn't give you all the answers because it allows the viewer or reader or whatever media it is to come up with their own interpretations, like Steve's interpretation that the light was him seeing his true self is something I never would have thought of. But the fact that he is experiencing the story so differently is so cool. It's like it's poetic. I know that's so corny, but like, I mean, it's so much different than watching a straightforward horror movie that's just there to be taken in as a story, whereas this is more like a choose your own adventure psychological thriller.
Okay, but Mitz, I need to ask now. So what's your favorite gothic tale?
Jane Eyre. And I don't really know if that counts. I know everyone says it's boring. You could say it's boring.
I mean,
I'll be mad.
She makes poor choices, but that's besides the point. That has nothing to do with the literature.
Well, okay, so cool thing about Jane Eyre is that there is a spinoff, like not a spinoff. What do I want to call this? It's like an alternate telling called White Sargasso Sea that's told from the point of view of like the woman in the attic. And it's so
oh, that's awesome.
It's very good. And it puts a whole new perspective on it. Anyway, yeah. Choose your own adventure movies.
Along with, I guess, to the side of that, just the whole, like, I don't generally like overly artsy films myself either, but I think one of the things I was thinking about that made this one a little more palatable was a lot of the stuff that we were talking about, but it also had this unique sense of humor about it. And, you know, just like all the like fart jokes. And one of my favorite parts is when they get like super drunk and they're like yelling at each other. And Ephraim's like, "And I hate your cooking, your lobster's crap," or, you know, however he says it. And then Willem Dafoe, Thomas Wake, just goes on this like blistering monologue of like hellfire and like, "Damn you for not liking my lobster." Oh, but before that, I love that, like, how hurt like he looks, like how well he plays that, like, "You don't like me, lobster?"
And then he goes on that
huge monologue, and then just at the end there's that like moment of silence, and then Ephraim's like, "Fine, have it your way. I like your lobster," or whatever he says.
That was the most couple moment ever. Like, "Yes, sweetie, I love you. It's fine. You're a wonderful cook. Just shut up."
Yeah, I really do like that scene a lot, too. Like you said, just how genuinely hurt he is by that moment. Like, yeah, you can just see it in his face, and oh, it's great.
Yeah.
This movie really delivered on the final scene. Everyone here knows that I'm real big on final scenes, and a lot of times it determines the tone of the movie for me. This was freaking awesome. That final shot was perfection. I'm going to say it right now. I've spoken.
It's pretty yucky.
How's the end of Prometheus being lashed to a rock and, yeah, continuously having his guts eaten now?
The whole time, yep. I was just thinking, mine.
No, I said that while I was watching it.
Oh, but that's awesome. It brings the Prometheus thing full circle.
Yeah.
Just to reiterate what else has been said, I think that this film is an artsy film that doesn't try too hard and gives you enough to be left up to interpretation without afterwards leaving you like with that feeling where you're supposed to like this because it's artsy, but you don't know why. This film definitely avoids that and does a really good job of like presenting itself and leaving itself up to interpretation still. So I really like that.
Also, the casting choices were, I don't think I would have watched this and enjoyed it for what it was had it not been the two actors who were cast in the lead roles. I believed them, even when the dialogue was laughable, you know, because of the circumstances. Yeah. It worked for me. I make fun of this movie all the time, but it's a really great movie.
They did such a phenomenal job, both of them. Like, they're very believable, and they did such a good job, both of them.
Very committed and really knocked it out of the park. And then it was kind of interesting too, just hearing about both of their processes and how both their characters and them personally as actors are so different, because, you know, you're hearing like Willem Dafoe coming from a theater background, wanting to kind of really rehearse everything and, you know, do everything beforehand, try everything beforehand, kind of have an idea of what they wanted. And Robert Pattinson kind of being like, "I don't want to over rehearse it and then lose all the spontaneity." So, you know, you've got the one, you know, Willem Dafoe being more rigid about the whole thing, same as his character. And then Robert Pattinson being more reserved and kind of reclusive in that way. And so it's kind of interesting how their different styles helped to inform their character's relationship on screen as well.
I did really want Willem Dafoe to be like, "Well, I'm a bit of a lighthouse keeper myself."
I was going to say, too, it's kind of mirrored in the thing at the beginning where, you know, Thomas Wake says that poem where he's like, should pale death with treble dread make the ocean caves our bed? God who hears the surges roll, deign to save the suppliant soul. And like, and Ephraim can't remember it in the beginning, but then in the end, he remembers it perfectly. So it's kind of like mirrors the actor's style to an extent, too. And also kind of reiterates the point of them being different stages of the same person, or father and son, or teacher and student, kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, that works really well. One random thing I'd come across about the mermaid was that, you know, the mermaid vagina was based off of a shark's vagina, apparently.
True story. Nice. I appreciated that they didn't make the mermaid too pretty. I hate it when they... first of all, mermaids are horrifying characters. They dragged sailors down to their death. Like, that's what they did. It was a good time. I really appreciated that this mermaid was, at first glance, attractive. And just at the same time, really kind of disturbing and horrifying. And I think that the shark genitalia definitely added to that. But the practical makeup skills that I saw, I was impressed with. They did not overdo this. This was very subtle. And I think that all of like the practical makeup that they had for the mermaid was just, it was made even better by the whole black and white vintage lens thing that they had going on too.
Yeah, for sure.
The mermaid definitely had the kind of look and feel of like art that was done, or paintings of women of that time period. My brother and I, our mom would collect all kinds of pictures from that era. And so, not from the 1890s specifically, but from like the 20s and 30s and things like that. It kind of reminded me, her look reminded me of those kind of depictions of women.
Brianna, when you were talking about that mermaids are just these horrible creatures that drag sailors down, I pictured like Ariel from The Little Mermaid, like down in her cave with all of her trinkets, but replaced with just a bunch of like,
but the trinkets, I don't know, are
sailor
people?
Skeletons.
Yeah. It's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but make it aquarium.
With singing.
Texas Chainsaw Aquarium.
It's a musical. Horror musicals. That's our next episode, right?
Yes, there's so many.
I've got livers and kidneys aplenty.
And we have to sing the whole episode because it's our musical.
Okay, hold on. I don't know that I can drink enough to do that. I will pass out.
Under the sea. I'd be down for a singing episode.
Yeah, we're not inviting you.
I think we don't want to alienate our audience more.
Is our singing horrible?
Probably.
Any other closing thoughts?
This could have all been avoided if they brought cats to the island.
Yes. Yes.
I think we didn't really talk too much about maybe the symbolism of the bird and killing a seabird and things like that. How that was kind of the tipping point that brought the curse on them and the storm. And the only reason I bring it up is because I wanted to quote Malcolm Reynolds and say that an albatross used to be a ship's good luck until some idiot killed it. So.
So one of the things that I kind of think is always just interesting is just kind of look at some of the, how it's classified amongst various streaming services. That's kind of something we've been bringing up at least at the end of each of these. More than usual, you have it labeled as horror, drama, sci-fi, thriller, suspense, independent, and then Wikipedia specifically not assigning a genre and just talking about that the genre is contested. And it was mostly an even spread with, I guess, a little bit more weight on the fantasy side of it than anything. So
What? That's so weird.
How would do you classify this as sci-fi?
Yeah. So there was that as well.
Oh, fantasy. Whose fantasy is this?
Yeah.
It's like they're throwing fantasy and sci-fi on everything that's fiction.
I think there's a lot of that when it goes back to Willem Dafoe's quote, right? Like, it's certainly a genre film, but then what genre? And I think so, like, you get the sci-fi fantasy label thrown on things that they're not sure what to label it.
That's just so weird. I can kind of sort of see the fantasy, like, because it's got the kind of folklore-y elements to it that's, I don't know. I guess that depends on what you define as fantasy, but I don't understand sci-fi at all. Yeah, I guess there's a mermaid, yeah. Or is there?
I'm going to say they're wrong. That's all.
Is it fantasy?
No, no.
Is it fantasy? The spinoff podcast. Someday I will catalog how many spinoff podcast names we've come up with. But not this day.
That'd be fun.
We've got in it, is it romance?
We should be doing trailers for those.
Any other final thoughts on this?
3 out of 5 dead seagulls.
4 out of 5 monkey pumps.
Oh, that's a good one. That's high praise.
It's a lot of monkey pump.
4 out of 5 weeks.
4 out of 5 chamber pots to the face.
Oh, did anybody else? Like, I cringed.
That scene was so bad. I knew it was going to happen.
Was from the soul.
Every single restaurant worker has gone into the walk-in to have that kind of a scream. I felt that in my soul.
Yeah, if somebody said that this was a horror comedy, I probably wouldn't be able to, like, refute that to them, actually.
Okay, so that's one of the things that's a little bit funny, too, because, you know, you've got Robert Eggers talking about, like, yeah, there's comedy elements in it, but The Witch, his first movie, was so kind of serious and dour throughout that people were, like, sitting there hearing, you know, honestly having fart jokes in this kind of art house film and not being sure how to react to it. It's like, can I laugh at that? And him kind of being like, yeah, it's funny. Go ahead, laugh at it. It's fine. It doesn't have to be like that. So it was funny to see that no one labeled it as comedy, because I do see that. I think that does make sense, is at least one of the tags on it.
Yeah, I think there's, I don't know, maybe it's subtle, but I think there's a lot of comedy in it.
Definitely a lot of funny moments, especially the one that you talked about with the comedic timing on Robert Pattinson's line and stuff like that. Like, definitely a lot of little laughs if you're looking for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us once again for another episode of Is It Horror? Join us next time. We're going to be talking about Pan's Labyrinth. So it should be a good one. And with an actual Spanish speaker here amongst us, maybe we can get some insight on that, since I've only ever seen it either dubbed or subtitled. So it'll be interesting. Well, thanks for joining us. And I've been Steve.
And I've been Brianna.
I'm Joe.
I'm Ephraim's penis.
And I'm Mitz.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for joining us at Is It Horror? We post new episodes every other Friday. Think we didn't give this movie a fair shake? Think we missed something? Do you have a suggestion for future episodes? Or did you just want to say hi? If so, you can follow us at Is It Horror on Twitter, on Instagram at Is It Horror Pod, or you can email us at isithorrorpodcast@gmail.com. In the meantime, stay safe and keep asking yourself,
Is It Horror?